Hello, everyone, and welcome to In the Know with Kat Bobineau. Today, my extra special guest is Dr. Brian Gangsler. He is an astrophysicist out here at UC Santa Cruz, but hails all the way from Australia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this. I love to talk to people about their careers in STEM, how they got started, to kind of give a option to those listening to say, hey, this is there for you, and no story is the same. No one goes on the same path. So let's just get started with astrophysics. What made you go into astrophysics?
Well, I have a very simple origin story. My parents bought me a book on astronomy when I was about 4 years old, and I read it and I thought, this is what I want to do. I still have that book. What I love about that book now, even though it's 40, 45 years old, is that at the time it said, oh, here are all these great mysteries of the universe that we have no idea what's going on. And everything in that book, every mystery in that book, there's an answer now. And all those answers are just in every astronomy textbook. There's nothing, no mysteries in that book that are left. But we, of course, have even bigger mysteries that we're now scratching our heads about. So it just shows you how much science changes and how fast things move, that one generation's greatest questions we would give anything to be answered are just now in the textbook. And I'm just constantly motivated, though, by that feeling of mysteries to be solved that I got from reading that book so long ago.
That is amazing. You know, most people don't find their calling at 4 years old. That's, you know, high school, college. Was it a kid's book about astronomy, or was it just something that your parents thought, oh, maybe he'll be interested in and we'll get him this book?
It was a kid's book. It was mainly pictures with just some sort of simple concepts in it. And, you know, my parents are always supportive of getting me to read in that. And it wasn't the only book they'd gotten me. But what was different about this one is the other books, the subtext, the message I was getting to my young brain was, we know everything. So if you bought a book on volcanoes, it just told you everything you need to know about volcanoes. And if you bought a book on dinosaurs, it said, here's everything we know about dinosaurs. But the astronomy book was phrased differently. It basically just said, we have no idea what's going on. And when you're 4 or 5, the idea that there are things that nobody knows the answers to, it's a sort of a radical idea. I mean, I grew up thinking my parents knew everything. Of course, once I was a teenager, I knew they knew nothing. And, you know, if my parents didn't know, then I could ask my teacher. And if my teacher didn't know, the library or the encyclopedia would know. And, of course, now the internet knows. And so the idea that there's something where nobody knows just shocked me, even at that young age. And then the book went on to say, well, there are these things that nobody knows, but there are these people. We don't just say, oh, well. There are these people who are trying to figure that out. And that's when I just thought, it wasn't so much I want to be an astronomer. It's like, I want to be the guy who figures out the things that nobody knows the answers to. And this book basically made the case that if you want the maximum number of things where nobody knows what's going on, like, astronomy is like the king of sciences for having more questions than answers. So just ever since that moment, I just was totally fixated. And I feel guilty that, as you said, that I figured it out so early, because I know that other people, including my own son and all the students I work with, like, they're still figuring it out. And I encourage them to, like, take a long journey and to sort of try different things. And they say, well, how did you get there? And I say, well, I actually had it all sorted at age 4. So I realize that's very unusual, and I feel incredibly blessed. And I would love to go back to that 4-year-old or 5-year-old and appear, step out of my time machine and say, you did it. And I can't imagine how he would feel to be told that. But I do continue to feel that responsibility to my young self to keep asking questions.
I absolutely love that response, because I did my master's research on kids in STEM and how it gets kind of pushed away when you're a child and you go to school, because you have all these questions, right? You have all the questions to ask, and either people say, I know it or I don't know it, but they don't typically encourage you to go find out yourself. Right. And so I like that concept of, oh, these people don't know what it is. Maybe you can learn it. And you're like, OK, yeah, I'm going to go learn it. And I'm going to spend the rest of my life fixing this and learning these answers to the questions that's in the book.
And I also find it interesting, like, you've worked on kids books. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, kids books are written to sort of kids books about science are sort of written to provide this reassuring voice that we understand things, that the world is knowable. And I think for kids that is really reassuring. I remember reading a book about weather. I was like terrified of tornadoes as a child, and knowing that we sort of understand some aspects of them and there's some level of predictability would be reassuring. But I don't understand why some science books are sort of hesitant to admit to the child that we don't know the answers. Like the best possible situation is a bit of, we understand this, but we don't know that.
Yeah, it's so funny that you said that. I recently was talking to someone about that, and I was like, to me, you are the smartest person in the room when you say, I don't know, you know, because you admit, hey, I don't know. I don't know everything. You know, people like to put other scientists and people on platforms, like they know all about every little thing. And it's not true. You know a lot about your discipline. You know, I admire Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson and his work. But I've seen people ask him stuff on like women's reproduction or, you know, like food and climate. I'm like, he may have an understanding, but that's not what he went to school for. You need to find a scientist on that level to ask.
It's quite liberating to say, I don't know, because what I normally say is, I don't know, but I will find out. And I will find out what the answer might be, and I will get back to you. So it's sort of like giving me homework and sending me a little mini research project.
I love it. I know that's the thing about it is, I don't know, but let's find out. You know, I have a 3-year-old, and he's starting the why yes. moments. You know, and
the questions. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know. Let's figure it out.
I can tell you a story about that. My own sort of warning is that when my son was about 9. He just got really into questions about space. And he kept asking me all these questions about space, and I just didn't know the answers. And he's like, well, you're an astronomer. Like, surely you would know the answers. But the questions you were asking weren't the sort of questions that astronomers ever think about. And so I said, I'm going to write a book for him, and I'm going to answer all the questions that he asked me. And so I wrote a book, a popular science book called Extreme Cosmos. And it took me about 2 years to finish. And I dedicated to him, and I handed him the book, and by this point he was like a sassy tween. He's like, I said, here are all the answers, and he said, oh, I don't care about that anymore.
Oh yes, I get that. That's so yeah. I was asked to write this children's books for this nonprofit organization like 2 years ago, but it was a nonprofit, so none of them could be sold. And a lot of people on social media were like, well, how do I buy this book? And I said, you can't. So then it made me want to write a book that you can buy, you can have. And so I started with 4, and it's based off of the Magic School Bus type of way where they can transform and go in and learn. But it's, you know, it's based off my son. His name is Carter. So his Carter can be an astrophysicist, a marine biologist, a seismologist, and an animal biologist. And one of my fears is in a few years, I'm going to be like, here are some books I wrote based off of you for you. And he's going to be like, eh, okay, thank you. I don't want this.
But that's their own people.
I know. But that's okay. I enjoyed the process of it. But anyway, I actually have your website pulled up, which is yourname.briangesler.net. Seeing this book, Extreme Cosmos, that's so interesting. So is it written for the teenage era, like teenage mind, I should say?
Not really. I mean, it's sort of written at an adult level, but I've had a lot of people or their kids write to me saying it was very accessible at that level. But it's written for someone who doesn't have a scientific background. Like, it's not technical. But yeah, lots of kids have read it and seem to have enjoyed it. It's based around the idea of the Guinness Book of World Records, but it's like that book has all the world records for Earth. What are the world records for the rest of the universe? So I sort of, because my son would ask me, what's the darkest place in the universe or what's the coldest place in the universe? And I would say to him, I have no idea. And it turns out that if you spend a lot of time digging, you can figure out the answers to these things.
Oh, that's very interesting. I would definitely have to look into that book because I'm looking at it right now like, oh, wow, all right. I love all that. So anyway, we done got all off. We're going back to you. About astrophysics, you decided at 4. Where did you go after that for college that you went to study astrophysics?
So I had an amazing high school science teacher who, well, I feel bad for him because of the 6 years I was in high school. He had 6 years of high school in Australia. He got me 4 of the 6 years. I got the same teacher. And so we got to know each other pretty well. And he sort of took me under his wing. And he sort of said, you know, if you're interested in astronomy, I was living in the city of Sydney. And he said, you know, he said the University of Sydney has a really good astronomy program, and I pretty much would do anything he said. So I didn't like do my own research or anything. I just did what he advised. And so I went to the University of Sydney for college. And I know in the US, if you go to graduate school, you normally would go somewhere else, but it's sort of the opposite in Australia. Most people just through inertia just stay at the same place. And so I stayed at the University of Sydney and did my PhD there as well. So I was there for about 8 years. And they do indeed have a very good astronomy department. And in fact, at the time I was there, they had 3 different astronomy departments. They're now all merged, but at the time there were 3. And so I was able to like do some studies in one department and then switch over to another one and get really good, broad training. The big thing that happened there was that growing up as a kid, I wanted to be what professionals would call an optical astronomer, someone who uses a normal telescope with like a tube and a mirror and a lens and an eyepiece, because I wanted to look at beautiful things. I wanted to stay up all night and look at beautiful things. And then one of the professors there was taking me to the telescope, and we were driving down the freeway. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was about a 2-hour drive down to where the telescope was, and the clouds were sort of massing. And I said to him, oh, I guess we won't be able to use the telescope tonight because it's going to be cloudy. And he said, oh no, this is a radio telescope. It can see through clouds. And at that moment I became a radio astronomer. So radio telescopes, dishes, satellites, like Jodie Foster in the movie Contact, which is sort of dating me, it's a long time ago, but she was a radio astronomer. They can see during the day, they can see when it's raining, they can see when it's cloudy. So a lot less heartbreak, and I've been a radio astronomer ever since.
Nice, nice, nice. So, okay, where did you go after college once you graduated?
So Australia is a small place, and there weren't a lot of jobs in Australia at the time. There are more now, but there weren't a lot at the time. So most people who want to stay in astronomy go abroad. So I applied for a NASA position. NASA have this program called the Hubble Fellowship, where it's very competitive, but they give you 3 years of funding and you can take it anywhere in the USA you want. So it's really nice. You get to look at a map and say, I want to go there. So I wanted to go to MIT. So I did, to my sort of shock, get a NASA fellowship, and I took it to MIT, and I was there for 3 years as a postdoc, which is this time you're now graduated, you're an actual astronomer and you have a job, but you're still learning, and you sort of associate yourself with a professor, a bit like being you know, medical doctors who have their degrees but are still sort of doing rotations and that sort of stuff. So I was at MIT for 3 years, saw snow for the first time, which was a bit of a shock. And then I got another 1 year postdoc at the Smithsonian, which is also the Smithsonian's. When people hear Smithsonian, they think Washington, D.C., but its biggest unit is actually its observatory, which is in Boston. So I was another year in Boston at the Smithsonian, and then, to my complete shock, was offered a professorship at Harvard. So I took that. So that was pretty amazing, like getting to be at MIT and the Smithsonian at Harvard with just these people who were just legends to me, people whose names were on textbooks, and I was like getting to talk to them. There was one time this guy sat down at Harvard next to me for lunch, and I introduced myself, and he said, oh, my name's Bob Wilson. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, that must be confusing, because that's that guy, Bob Wilson, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the beginning of the universe. And he's like, yeah, that's me. It was like that a lot at Harvard. So I was at Harvard for 4 years. Did you want me to keep going through the...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm loving this story. I'm all in.
So I think it was a really great place, a really special, amazing place. But an opportunity came back in Australia. I thought I was sort of done with Australia. Like, you know, I love Australia and like going home, but my career sort of called me elsewhere. But this amazing job came up in Australia, which would involve millions of dollars of funding, and I could sort of build my own center. And so without really planning this, I ended up back in Australia in after 4 years at Harvard. And I was back in Australia for about 10 years. And then another great opportunity came up in Toronto, in Canada. And so we moved the family to Canada, back to the snow, for about 10 years. And then just a few months ago, moved to California and to Santa Cruz. So I haven't had any sort of master plan or clever strategy, just interesting things come up. And, you know, one of my mentors once told me is that when the bus pulls up at the bus stop and the doors open, like if the destination sounds interesting, get on the bus. He said, you can always get off at the next stop if you realize it's wrong. So you know, I've taken that to heart, and that means that I've had this incredibly fantastic and privileged opportunity to live in different countries and to work at amazing places.
Yeah, that is awesome, because I think a lot of times people from the United States don't think about getting on that bus to go to a different country. It's kind of like, you know, stay here, do this. This is wonderful. And, you know, I've been to Australia. I didn't live there, but I've been to Australia for a couple of weeks, and it was amazing. And I tried to go to Australia, but Australia has a strict rule that they're going to hire their own before they hire someone from the outside. And I was this close to getting a job there, but then I guess they found someone. But I was ready to go. I was ready to be like, oh, yep, let's go to Australia.
Yeah, it's much easier to get a it's much easier to be a foreigner in the US than it is to be a foreigner in Australia. Australia has this like point system, and if I'm an Australian citizen, so I can, you know, get a job in Australia. But if I was applying for the point system, I would not, even right now, I would not be able to get enough points to get in. It's really all about your bank balance. So yeah, it's a bit of a closed place. But moving countries has been really hard. Like Canada, Australia, USA, I mean, they're not too different from each other, but each country really is different. And it's been really hard to move to a new country and understand how it works. But it's also, in hindsight, I'm so glad I did it, because you just meet so many different people, and your view of the world changes when you live in different countries with different ways of doing things. And to me, I know it sounds funny to you and to your listeners, but you know, the US is a foreign country to me, and moving here has been a big adjustment.
Well, I'm sure it has been. I mean, like I said, I was only in Australia for 2 weeks. I'm pretty sure even if I did get the job, I would have been there like, I don't know what I'm doing. Where am I supposed to go to? Go to the doctor? Where do I go to get groceries? And our mutual person that introduced me to you, you know, we met in New Zealand and we were roommates there. And even there in New Zealand, it's very beautiful, but there's a lot of different things moving, going on. And you're like, okay, I don't know. Where am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to do? So I can only imagine how difficult it can be to move to a different country.
And if I can throw shade at all my New Zealand friends, the problem with being in New Zealand is you cannot understand what anybody is saying.
Well, I think I did pretty good at understanding, and you know, we had a good time while we were there. And yeah, I actually did not want to leave New Zealand. Comparing New Zealand to California or to the United States, I was like, I'd rather be there. It's clean, it's nice, the people are cool. I'd rather be there. But yeah, anywho, I love everything that you are talking about. And you've only been a few months at UC Santa Cruz. I could have sworn you were there much longer.
Yeah, I just moved here in August. So it's only been 4 months.
So have you gotten research students yet?
No, I'm not looking to take on any students here just yet, because I'm now the dean. So I have a lot of, I'm the dean of science. So I have a lot of administrative responsibilities. And I also have a lot of people that I left behind in Toronto. I still have 8 students and 3 or 4 staff there. So I've sort of got my hands full with students. As all my Toronto team starts to graduate and finish in the next few years, I think I'll start ramping up with students in Santa Cruz. But just understanding a new university and how it works has been a big job. You'd think that the basic concept of a university is simple enough, and that every university would have somewhat similar ways of doing things, but every place is completely different. And it's like moving to a country where you don't speak the language and trying to learn the language, but also having a job in that language at the same time.
Wow. Okay. Well, I see that your research interests include cosmic magnetism, time domain astrophysics, and interstellar gas. Can you explain to someone who's never taken an astrophysics course what those interests mean?
It's pretty simple. The first one is very simple. The whole universe is magnetic, and we don't know why. And I would like to know why the universe is magnetic. It turns out that if you ask, if you pick up a magnet and say, why is this object magnetic? How did we make it magnetic? It turns out that the simplest way to make a magnet is using another magnet. You can take a nail and you can stroke it with a magnet, and the nail will become magnetic. So then you say, all right, well, where did that magnet get its magnetism from? And where did that magnet get its magnetism from? And then you eventually go back to like, well, the Earth is magnetic. And then you say, well, where did the Earth get its magnetic field from? And you keep going back and back, and you eventually get to this sort of primordial question about where did the first magnetic field in the universe come from? And we just don't know. So I would like to figure that out. It turns out to be pretty important for life on Earth. If it wasn't for magnetism, we would not exist, because the Earth's magnetic field, which is creating such spectacular auroras over the last week or two, It protects us from a lot of nasty stuff. Planets without magnetic fields, it's very hard to see how life could survive. So understanding how common it is, I mean, a lot of astronomy these days is about, you know, are we alone? How many planets out there have life on them? Part of that story isn't just about planets to the right temperature or the right gravity, but that planet also has to have magnetism. And so until we understand the circumstances that produce magnetism, we're not really in a position to say how common life is in the universe.
Okay, yeah, that's so interesting because one of my kids' books is like an ABC of astrophysics, and it's the habitable zone, which is the zone where life can live. And it's like, well, you think about the running water, the oxygen, or if there's sulfur-based creatures, maybe, whatever. But you need to have water and you need to have carbon. But I don't think that we really consider the magnetism aspect of it.
Yeah, and that makes me sort of, these sorts of things, like there's so many things you have to have. And that sort of makes me sort of pessimistic as to just how much life there is. But the universe is a big place. But magnetism is certainly a key part. And it's not one that most people think about. If you want to really annoy a professional astronomer, listen to their beautiful presentation and let them dazzle you with all their calculations. And at the end, put your hand up and say, have you considered the effect of magnetism? And normally the answer is no, because it's really hard. Because you can't see magnetism. You can point the Hubble Space Telescope at anything and perhaps see it, but if it's magnetic, you can't see the magnetism. So I sort of liken studying magnetic fields as sort of doing a crossword puzzle without any clues. We study magnetism throughout the universe, but because you can't see it, you've really got to think about ways in which it affects other objects and do it all indirectly.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, what about time domain? What is time domain astrophysics?
Yeah, so that's another fancy pants word that just means something very simple. You know, when you go up at night and you look at the stars, they still look the same as the night before. Like our constellations have like Roman and Greek names, and that's because they're the same constellations that the Romans and Greeks saw. So, you know, it's tempting to say the sky doesn't change. But if you look more carefully, the sky does change, and it changes both slowly. The constellations are slowly shifting in their shapes over thousands or millions of years. But there are also these very fast changes. There are these flashes and burps and belches that happen in the sky, some of them on timescales of like a nanosecond, others on the timescale of an hour or a month. There's constant, if you could see the sky with super telescope eyes, you'd see all these different things flashing and disappearing and flaring and vanishing all the time. And some of these are well-known things, like a star giving off a flare. But others are mysterious types of explosions or events. Like black holes forming or black holes dying that we really don't understand at all. So the first challenge is to somehow monitor the whole sky all the time to build like a fisheye lens that can catch these things. Because if you're looking to the left and one goes off to the right and you go, what was that? By the time you turn over your shoulder, it's gone. Mm-hmm. So you really need to look at the sky all the time, which creates enormous challenges in terms of technology and data. And then once you've solved that and you can actually catch these things in the action, you then have to figure out what's going on. And they tend to sometimes be some of the most energetic and violent things in the universe, like stars colliding or black holes exploding and all that sort of stuff. So it's really testing these ridiculous, extreme types of events that you could never test in a laboratory.
Wow. Yeah. I think I saw a post on Instagram. I don't know how real it was, though, but it was the sounds of the universe, right? And it was some good comments in there. It's like, well, if there's no space, in space, there's no sound. Because it's a vacuum. Or is it sound? Because there's things happening like an explosion or a flare.
Yes, so I read a whole chapter about this in the book I mentioned, Extreme Cosmos, about sounds in the universe. And the third thing I think on my webpage that I study, like interstellar gas. So the universe is a better vacuum than any vacuum we can make on Earth. It's very rarefied gas, but it's still not completely empty. So there is gas in space, and you can have sound waves in that gas. So there are sounds in space. Space is quite noisy. But the amazing thing is if you work out what those sounds are, so firstly, they're really loud. Like a lot of them are over 100 decibels, sort of jackhammer level sounds. But they are notes that are something like 35 octaves below middle C, like hundreds of keys off the left end of the keyboard. So the notes in space are very, very deep notes. The note are so deep that you would have to listen for about a million years just to be able to hear one full cycle of the note. So they're not notes that our human ears could hear, but they are genuine notes. You can calculate them. You can point at that black hole and say that black hole is producing a B flat and that object is producing like an E. You can do that, but the notes are very, very deep. And we could never actually hear them. But if you say, well, music or sound is simply a sound wave, a vibration of gas, then that is exactly what we are seeing.
Wow. So there is sound. We may not be able to hear it, or it'll take a very long time for us to hear it, but there is sound happening in the universe.
There is absolutely sound in space, but to the human ear, it would be completely quiet.
Interesting.
So everybody's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, learn something new every day. So I know that we only had a short amount of time, so I don't want to hold you up from whatever you have next, but I do want to say thank you very much for giving me this time to learn all about you, or at least a tidbit about you, not all about you, and the work that you do.
Thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll give you back your Wednesday. I appreciate everything.
Okay.
All right. I did want to say, if you have any last thing or anything you wanted to say to the audience or nice little goodbye, you are very welcome.
Well, I guess what I'd say, like comparing my own journey to others, I would say that if you have a dream as a young child, don't, you know, think about, take it seriously and think about whether that's what you want to do with your life. I think there should be sort of a human right that if there's something you're excited about, then you should be allowed to do it, especially in a rich and privileged country like the United States. But if you don't have that revelation, you don't know what you want to do, that's okay too. Like, just enjoy the journey. So I think that the biggest reward that I've had is just doing new things and being exposed to new ideas. And I just hope that everyone can find a path where they get to think about new things.
Wow. I love it. Okay. All right. Thank you again, and have a good rest of your afternoon.
Thanks so much. All the best.
All right.